Let's all stipulate that we are in session. Thank you. Thank you to the law clerk Marshall for that. So this panel of the court today's date is June 23, 2020. This panel of the court has three cases set for oral argument today, all three by oral argument. All three oral arguments will take place by WebEx video conferencing. I would like to do just a sound check of the participants. Let's start with Judge Shellhouse. Can you hear and see me, Judge Shellhouse?
Yes, I can. I can hear you and see you.
Okay, very good. And Judge Cochran, we understand you'll be on audio only, not video, but can you so far hear everybody okay?
I can, yes, thank you.
Okay, very good. Ms. McGillick, what about you?
Yes, I can hear and see everyone.
Okay, very good. And I assume that Mr. Erickson can as well. And both counsel see the time clock?
Yes.
If you have the gallery view, I believe you will always see that, even if you have the sort of the alternative view with the speaker in a large format and other people in small tiles. I think because there are few enough of us, the time clock will always be there as well. Mr. Erickson, on behalf of appellant, you may begin. And as you know, you have 15 minutes for your initial argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the appellant this morning, Cody Bergendahl. We have raised three issues in our brief. I would like to start this morning by addressing the biased juror issue, but I'm happy to move on to the other issues if time allows me to do so. If the constitutional right to a fair trial means anything, it is that a defendant has a right to have every juror state unequivocally that they can be fair. In this case, Mr. Bergendahl was not afforded this right because Juror 27's final statement under oath was that she honestly did not know if she could be fair. As a result, Mr. Bergendahl is requesting that this court reverse his conviction and remand for a new trial because the trial court abused its discretion and committed structural error by denying his motion to strike Juror 27 for cause. First, the trial court abused its discretion by finding that Juror 27 did not express an actual bias. Juror 27 made multiple statements that were clear expressions that she was biased because her daughter was a victim of domestic violence. She said in many different forms that her bias might affect her ability to be fair and that she was having doubts about whether she could be impartial.
Well, Mr. Erickson, could I stop you there? What about the issue that it seems like there's not a perfect match between the allegations in this case and the prior incidents involving Juror 27's daughter? What we have here is a single instance of alleged criminal sexual assault. In the prior case, there was ongoing domestic violence. I take it that means between people who live together. Is that a legitimate factor in the analysis?
I don't think so, Your Honor. For an actual bias claim, the question is whether the juror is biased. The reason why doesn't really fit into the analysis. For example, if for some reason the juror said, you know, I don't like the color green and Mr. Bergendahl is wearing a green shirt and I don't think I can be fair because of that. If that juror could not unequivocally state that she could be fair, that juror is actually biased. On the other side of it, in a case like State v. Fraga, if a juror said, you know, I know everything about the case, I read every newspaper article about the prior trial, I know he was convicted, but I can be fair, that juror is not biased. So the reason why a juror is biased does not fit into the analysis for an actual bias claim. The only question is whether the juror was actually biased. And that's in contrast to if we infer bias under the other factors of the rule, then you would look actually at what the reason was behind it. So I don't think that this court needs to consider whether it was similar to the domestic abuse that her daughter suffered or not. The question is whether the fact that she said that she could not be fair or could not unequivocally say that she could be fair resulted in her being actually biased.
Counsel?
Another question. Go ahead, Judge Shellhouse.
Counsel, I'm wondering, in this case, it appears that defense counsel did not ask the district court to give the jury a curative instruction.
Are you talking about the issue regarding the prosecutorial misconduct?
Oh, you know what? I think. Never mind. Strike that.
I had another question, Mr. Erickson, that has to do with, is this case different because of, well, I should say, what is our analysis in light of the fact that, and let me just first clarify, there was a post-trial motion with respect to the biased juror issue, correct?
That's correct.
And the district court made a ruling on that post-trial motion. And explained in a way the district court's interpretation of the woman's comments. To what extent do we give deference to the district court's post-trial ruling?
Well, you know, as we know, the judge is obviously in the best position to make these credibility determinations, but the ultimate decisions were an abuse of discretion. In the court's order, the district court did not discuss that final statement by the juror that she honestly did not know that she could be fair. That never came into the court's analysis. It was also factually inaccurate in that the court did not or made the statement that she said that she could be fair when she never made that statement. The court also made the finding that there was not a clear and strong deep impression. Well, the juror said that because of her daughter's domestic abuse experience, that resulted in her not being sure if she could be fair. So that's an expression of actual bias. So even considering the findings that the judge made in the post-trial motion, those findings were clearly erroneous and an abuse of discretion. And also the court did not conduct any sort of rehabilitation analysis in that post-trial motion as well. So I don't think that order can be relied on to find that the juror was not biased or that she was actually rehabilitated.
Would you agree that some of the questions that the court asked during voir dire were rehabilitative in nature?
They were attempted to be rehabilitative in nature, but again, when the final statement is, I honestly don't know if I can be fair, I don't think that anyone can say that that is a unequivocal statement that the juror could be fair. So even though that there may have been attempts, I think that the judge may have been confused, you know, whether the judge was actually trying to find actual bias or rehabilitating at that point, because those questions were geared towards rehabilitation. But clearly the last statement that she made was not an unequivocal statement that she could be fair. And also, as far as giving deference goes to, the Supreme Court has made clear that that deference goes to after a juror says that they are actually biased and they're trying to rehabilitate the juror. If the juror says in some sort of way, I think I can be fair, yes, then the deference goes to the judge to determine whether or not that statement was a clear and unequivocal statement that the juror could be fair. In contrast, in this case, that final statement, I honestly don't know if I can be fair, if the judge didn't, the judge's deference towards that is saying that the judge didn't believe her and that the judge and that the juror actually was saying that she could be fair. So I've never found a case where a judge is saying that the juror was lying and therefore the juror could be fair. So it's not that the judge was making a determination that she was rehabilitated. It was that she was lying to the judge when she said she could not be fair. So I think that analysis is a little bit backwards and clearly was unequivocal that she could be fair.
Counsel, in the district court's post-trial order, the court suggested that juror 27's comments about being fair or not sure that she could be fair are similar to any doubts that every juror feels. Would you address that based on your knowledge of the case law?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'd be in trouble if every juror's final statement was, I honestly don't know if I can be fair. That's not the same doubt as every juror has. If there may be a case where a juror says, you know what, I'm not sure if I can be fair. I don't like these sexual abuse cases. I have a history with domestic abuse, but then is rehabilitated at the end by saying, you know what, I can follow the court's instructions. I will do my best to be fair. After understanding, you know, what's going to be taking place here, I will be fair. That's a situation where a juror has doubts, but is then rehabilitated. And that did not happen here. The juror made multiple statements where she did not know if she could be fair or not. And then at the end said, I honestly don't know if I can be fair. So I think that's very different than a juror, you know, the first time being on a jury and not being sure how to handle the situation given a juror's specific past.
Counsel, in this case, the last question that the district court asked this juror was, in your heart of hearts, do you think you can be fair? And the juror said, I don't know. I honestly don't know. Are you familiar with any case that has facts similar to that, a published case in which the juror was seated?
Absolutely not. I think that the state has cited to a couple unpublished cases, one being the Goulette or Goulet case. And even in that case,
I'm interested in published cases.
I've not seen a published case by this court or by the Supreme Court where a equivocal statement that the juror honestly didn't know if they could be fair was treated as not being actually a biased statement or treated as being a rehabilitative statement. So absolutely not.
Counsel, this is Judge Cochran. I'm sorry, my camera does not appear to be working this morning. This is a recent development, so I apologize for that. There was a question to the juror by the defense counsel asking, what I'm wondering is, can you completely set aside the past about your daughter and the children when hearing new things in this trial? And the answer is, yep, I could do that. And it appears that the district court focused on that in part. Can you address, given the extremely deferential standard of review here, when you view that statement in context, is that sufficient to alleviate a concern of bias?
I don't think so for a couple of reasons. First, if you look at two questions later, the defense counsel asked, do you think what you went through, as you've just discussed here, would affect how you would think about a case like this? And she says, I hope not, but I can't say 100%, but yeah. So two questions later, the juror contradicted that statement that she could put aside her past and view new things. And also, more importantly than that, is that, you know, we have to look at this in context. And when the juror was getting these questions, she may have answered some questions that, she was thinking about this and potentially may not be biased. But you have to look at what happened subsequent to that when the juror had more of an opportunity to think about this and make an honest assessment after all of these questions, was that she honestly did not know if she could be fair. So I think you have to look at it in context of what took place subsequent to that one question. If that would have been the final question and she could affirmatively say along with that she could be fair, we'd be in a different situation. But as the conversation played out, I think we want jurors to really think about this. And when they're on examination from two attorneys and a district court judge, I think it takes some time for the jurors to really think about what's going on and whether they honestly can be fair. So I think you can't look at that in isolation. You have to look at that question and answer in context with what she said towards the end of the conversation.
Thank you.
Yep. And also, I really think this court should focus on what took place in Fraga. You know, that juror could not equivocally say that he could be fair. He prefaced a lot of his answers with comments saying that he didn't know if he could follow instructions or he could be fair. And that's exactly what happened in this case, where every statement was pretty much equivocal along the whole way. And then at the end, that final statement, you can't get around the fact that she was never able to say unequivocally that she could be fair.
Mr. Erickson, you're putting a lot of emphasis on the last statement. And is there case law to the effect that courts should give more weight to the last thing that was said if there's any conflict or tension between the last thing and things that were said previously.
You know, I can't think of any case off the top of my head that specifically says that, but I think how we have conversations and the whole idea that we start off by the actual bias analysis and then do the rehabilitation, it does flow from beginning to end that a juror would start the conversation by discussing whatever reason it may be that they may be biased, go back and forth in a conversation. And then what really matters, especially in the rehabilitation phase of the conversation, is that they have to unequivocally say that they can be fair. So I think we have to think of it, the common sense of it, that that's how conversations work. And that's how the court's analysis of rehabilitation would always be towards the end of the conversation. And in State v. Logan, the Supreme Court case, they do talk about how difficult it is for jurors to be under this type of examination and be presented with leading questions, and how important it is for the jurors to be able to say honestly what they believe and not just be led in one way or the other down a road, to be able to say that they can be fair and impartial, that we should take a statement like the one here as her honest statement that she didn't know if she could be fair. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I can respond in my rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Erickson. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Ms. McGillick, on behalf of the state.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Karen McGillick. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the state. I would like to start with first the statement that was made about whether or not the reason behind the bias matters. And I think it's important that in the first step of any juror bias analysis that we start with whether there was actually an expression of actual bias. And this has been defined in case law very clearly to mean that the juror has to exhibit some strong and deep impressions that would prevent her from laying aside her impressions and rendering a verdict based on the evidence. That is the standard. And so the judge in his final or in his order that was analyzing the post-trial motion really focused on whether or not there were these strong and deep impressions about rape, in this case, a single incident of rape that had occurred at one time versus multiple incidents of physical abuse that had occurred in Juror 27's daughter's situation. And that was a very relevant period or point for the court to look at in determining whether there was an expression of actual bias. The district court focused on the fact that because these situations were so different, that the situation that the juror's daughter had experienced was a domestic situation involving multiple incidents, that did not show that this particular juror had a strong or deep impression about rape, or particularly in this case, a one instance type of rape. And although, you know, the juror was very honest during her examination about her concerns that any juror would have about whether or not she could be fair and impartial, when that point was brought to the juror's attention during the voir dire, and she was specifically asked, can you completely set aside the past about your daughter and children when hearing new things in this trial, juror 27 unequivocally answered, yep, that I could. And then as the examination continued, was asked whether she would give the victim in this case the same amount of credibility as any other witness. Again, she unequivocally answered yes. And also went on to say that she would not necessarily give any favorability to the fact that she was abused as being true or more true than any other statement. And she said that she would be able to listen to both sides and fairly evaluate the evidence. So in this case, that was very key to the district court's decision and why there was not an expression of actual bias.
Now, Ms. McGillick. Oh, go ahead. Okay. Judge Cochran.
Okay. I'm sorry, Judge Shulhas.
No, go ahead.
Ms. McGillick, but in the question with questioning by defense counsel, juror 27 also answered that she wasn't 100% sure that her daughter's experience wouldn't affect how she thought about this case. So, you know, you're trying to draw a distinction between what her daughter went through and that this was a single event, but doesn't that her answer to that question suggest that the distinction isn't completely, that there isn't a basis to say that just because there were this was a single event, and those that her daughter experienced multiple events that it doesn't affect whether she is biased or not.
I merely pointed it out because, you know, she did, like most jurors, express, you know, some concern about her ability to be impartial, but then also made it very clear that she wanted to be impartial, that she wanted to be fair. And then upon further questioning, made clear that she would listen to both sides, that she would not give one witness, favorability in their testimony over another witness, that she wasn't coming into the trial with a strong or deep impression that the defendant was guilty and the state was correct. Those were the type of questions that they were sorting out about any concern she had about whether her past situation would impact her. And I think what was kind of telling in the colloquy is that when they asked her, now this situation involved just one incident, does that change your opinion at all? And she then unequivocally said, yep. I mean, it's different. It's not an ongoing kind of deal. I'm not close to it. So the judge, when evaluating the credibility and sort of overall with taking her demeanor, he had described her as having her affect and everything else about the way in which she testified to that. The judge found that to be very convincing evidence that the fact that these situations were different indicated that she didn't have a very strong or deep impression about who was guilty in this case or who she would believe, and that was important.
Now, counsel, 100%. Counsel, if I may interrupt you, I'm quite troubled by the fact that the last comment this juror made was, I think we can all assume, an honest comment that she did not know whether or not she could be fair. She said that was an honest comment. And we know why she was concerned about her ability to be fair. It was the situation involving her daughter. No one attempted to rehabilitate her after she made that comment. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked your opponent, and that is whether or not you're familiar with any case law in which the last comment a juror makes is very unequivocal about her ability to be fair. And the district court nevertheless seated that juror, and an appellate court affirmed.
I don't have a published case. The two, Goulet and Conception, that I cited in my brief were both unpublished cases that involved very similar facts. And in fact, in Conception, it was this exact thing was he wasn't sure he could be 100% certain that he could be fair. And this court did, it was not.
If I might interrupt, in this particular case, it is true that that 100% phrase was used earlier by the juror. And I guess we do hear that a lot in voir dire when people say, well, I'm not 100% sure. But in this particular case, I mean, the final answer is, when asked, do you think you can be fair? She says, I don't know. I honestly don't know.
And I believe this is precisely where the abuse of discretion standard is so important in evaluating these type of cases. The judge who ultimately ruled on the post-trial motion and made findings on this was the one who was sitting in the room, not relying on a cold transcript, able to assess this statement that was made in the full context of the voir dire. And juror bias case law is very clear that we don't just focus on one statement, even if it is the last statement that the juror made, that the juror's statements cannot be viewed in isolation. They have to be viewed in the full context of the entire voir dire. And in this case, the judge was able to evaluate her sort of detached affect as she was talking about it, and the very unequivocal statement she made that she would be fair. You know, there were earlier statements where she said that she recognized that the situation her daughter went through was different, where she recognized that she would be able to listen to the evidence and fairly evaluate the evidence, and that she was not going to favor one testimony or the testimony of one witness over that of another. And that is what the case law has said is so important in determining whether there's actual bias and in assessing rehabilitation. And so I think in this case, we can't just focus on the fact that the last statement was what the judge said is probably what any juror, if they're being honest, says. Of course, they don't know if they're going to be able to come and how they're going to feel. But I think there's also a big, big difference between a juror saying, I can't necessarily forget about everything in my past. And that when you read the context of this juror's voir dire, It sounds to me like she is saying, and I think this is how the judge viewed it, she's saying, I can't necessarily 100% certainly say I'm not going to think about my own personal experience. I'm not going to be able to not remember what happened with my daughter. But we don't expect jurors to do that. We don't expect jurors to set aside all of their personal experiences and come into trial in a vacuum. What we expect them to do is to fairly evaluate the evidence, not to favor the testimony of one witness over the other, and to commit that they will do that. This juror did that on multiple occasions. She did unequivocally say that she would do that. And that was what was ultimately enough to convince the judge. And those findings that the judge made are not just entitled to deference, but the case law has made clear they're entitled to great deference, that the deference should be at its pinnacle in these type of cases. And so if the judge in the room listening to her was convinced that her earlier unequivocal statements outweighed that final statement, then I believe this court should give deference to that.
Well, what about the fact that one of the judge's findings is incorrect? In the court's order, the judge misstated what the juror had been asked. The court said, when asked whether she should set aside what happened to her daughter and be fair and impartial, juror 27 responded, yep, that I could. That is an inaccuracy with respect to what that juror was asked. When the juror responded, yep, that I could, there was nothing about fairness or impartiality as part of the question before the juror.
Am I right? That may not have been the most, certainly you're correct. I wouldn't disagree with that reading of it. But when you read the entire colloquy that's outlined on page 28 of my brief, you know, what was asked of the juror where that yep statement came in was, can you completely set aside the past about your daughter and the children when hearing new things in this trial? Yep, that I could. And so I think the juror, you know, when you read that in context, what they're asking is, can you set aside and take in the new evidence at face value without biasing yourself one way toward the other? And then the follow-up question was that, would you give the complainant the same amount of credibility as any other witness? Unequivocally, she answered yes. So when viewing that, I think the judge took those statements to mean that she would fairly evaluate the evidence and set aside her past when doing so. I think maybe the judge's order could have written it more, maybe quoted it more accurately, but the entire theme of what is behind it, I think, is still true. So, unless there are further questions on the issue, I would think that although the unpublished decisions in Goulet and Conception, I recognize that they're not binding on this court, but the facts in those cases are so similar and certainly more similar than any of the published decisions that I was able to locate. And they show, and I think establish, that when evaluating cases like Fraga and other cases, that this case is different from Fraga. There is no evidence in this case that this juror came in with sort of outside facts about the case or a very strong and deep impression about how she was going to rule. And she may have been unsure whether she could 100% set aside her personal experiences, but that she did commit to wanting to be impartial. She did commit to listening to both sides, and she did commit that she would not favor the victim's testimony over that of the defendant. And in the whole entire context, also made clear that she had no very strong impressions about rape cases in general, notwithstanding her past experience with her daughter's domestic abuse situation. So even to the extent that there is an actual bias, which the state maintains there was not, that final statement that the juror made does not negate the fact that the district court could have found that there was rehabilitation, and that this court, viewing the record, could also find that this juror was adequately rehabilitated, even if she did express some sort of a bias. And for all of those reasons, the state would then ask this court to affirm the appellant's conviction. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. McGillick. It appears that there are no further questions from the panel. I will wait a moment for the marshal to reset the clock. Mr. Erickson, you may go ahead with rebuttal.
Thank you. The district court never made a finding related to credibility related to the juror 27's last statement. The district court didn't mention it at all in its post-trial motion or post-trial order, except for in the facts section. So we have no credibility determination related to that. There's nothing regarding the way she made that statement or her demeanor when she made it that resulted in the judge finding that it was not a statement of actual bias or was rehabilitated. So I don't think there's any deference given to that statement when the judge didn't even recognize that it took place. In conception, the final statement the juror made was, "I believe I can." That's very different than, "Honestly, I don't know." In Glay, the final statement was, "I think I can, I will do my best." That's very different than, "Honestly, I do not know." And finally, a mother's experience with her daughter's past domestic abuse can absolutely result in a strong and deep impression on a juror. This idea that it has to somehow be similar to the exact offense that the defendant is on trial for is just not supported by any case law, and just goes against what we're talking about when we're talking about whether a juror can be fair. If a juror cannot state that she can honestly be fair, no matter what the reason, but especially because her daughter was a victim of domestic abuse, that results in that juror being actually biased, and she must be rehabilitated at some point during that jury, that conversation.
There must be limits to that concept. I mean, if, I'm somewhat inclined to give, you know, I mean, this, I mean, during voir dire, of course, this prospective juror did not understand the nature of the case, probably. And the district court probably had a better sense of what the evidence would show. I mean, isn't, I mean, if the, well, I don't know. Let me go back to the principle, though. I mean, is there case law that expressly says that bias for any reason, even if it's, I mean, bias based upon a past experience, which is dissimilar to the facts of the case, is not, you know, considered a ground to consider the juror bias for purposes of sitting as a juror in that case. I mean, is there a case law that explores that issue in depth?
I don't think there's anything in depth, but I think we have to discuss, you know, what we're talking about here, and that is, you need to have the juror be able to, for whatever reason, the juror has to be able to be fair. And if the defendant sitting at counsel table is sitting there watching a juror say, "I don't, honestly don't know if I can be fair," for whatever reason, that juror is actually biased. I don't think we need to take it to that extreme in this case. I think the reasons that she explained regarding her daughter are clearly sufficient enough. If the juror's daughter was a victim and she has an issue with the fact that this defendant is on trial and there's going to be a victim, I that has to be enough to establish actual bias, unless, of course, she can say that she can be fair. And again, I think the facts of Fraga are...
Let me drill down on that just a bit. I mean, I think that there are times where a juror might say, "I've had bad experiences with police officers." Mm-hmm. And because of the generality of that statement, we don't know anything about those experiences, then I suppose we must regard that comment as being generally biased towards police officers. If a potential juror says, "My daughter was the victim of domestic abuse," so then we have a specific understanding of the specific reasons for her feelings. Isn't it fair to interpret that to mean, if this defendant was alleged to have engaged in domestic abuse, I would have a bias against him. But then the corollary being, if he was accused of something else, then I'd be fine. I mean, is the district court permitted to engage in that type of reasoning? And are we, as a court of appeals, entitled or permitted to engage in that kind of reasoning?
I see I only have 20 seconds left, if I could.
Take your time.
I think in this case, if the judge, after that final statement of "I honestly don't know," then explored that and said, "You know, we had just talked about the potential difference of this case and your past experience. Now you're saying that you don't know if you can be fair. Can you explain the difference between the two and why that might be?" I think that would have been an okay conversation, but that never took place. And also, I think the fact that she's the alleged victim in this case is a victim of a rape, of a man against a woman, is, you know, the only reason we're not calling that domestic abuse is because it falls under a different statute and they may not have had a romantic relationship in the past. But it's very similar in that someone is being harmed by the conduct of a male on a female in this case. So, you know, if you want to split hairs about that, I think I can make that argument. But I think the bigger point that I want to make is that if the juror can't say she can be fair because her daughter was a victim of a domestic violence, I think that has to be enough. And if it's not enough, the judge needs to explore that and ask further questions and not rest on the final statement of, I honestly don't know if I can be fair.
I think you were making another point before I interrupted you. Do you want to make one more point in your rebuttal?
No, I'm good. I was just responding to what you were saying. I appreciate it, though.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute. Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The Court of Appeals is now in recess.